speech that he delivered inside the remains of the old Nazi-era German legislative building, the Reichstag, the Nobel Prize-winning philosopher and activist Elie Wiesel, he talked about the importance of remembering, especially remembering wrongs that have been done. "We remember Auschwitz," he says, "and all that it symbolizes because we believe that in spite of the past and its horrors, the world is worthy of salvation, and salvation, like redemption, can be found only in memory." And that was a prominent theme in Wiesel's writing, the importance of remembering, the obligation, you could say, to never forget the wrongs that were committed and to allow their memory to shape how we live in the present. And for him, this wasn't just some abstract concept. It was very personal. In his memoir, Night, where he recounts his own experience as a prisoner in two different Nazi concentration camps, there's a famous passage where Wiesel talks about his own conviction that he shall never forget what was done to him. "Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp that turned my life into one long night 7 times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the small faces of the children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke under a silent sky. Never shall I forget the flames that consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to ashes. Never shall I forget those things. Even were I condemned to live as long as God himself, never." And many who have read those words have found them insightful, stirring, inspiring even. And many would agree with what Wiesel is saying there and his conviction that there are some things we just can never forget. But how ought we to respond to such memories? And what does it mean to remember things well, to remember them rightly? This is a question that comes up in a very striking way in chapters 24 and 25 of Deuteronomy. Although the instruction that Moses gives is really kind of confusing, because twice in these two chapters are the people of Israel told to remember moments of suffering and of injustices that they endured. But the way that they are told to remember these moments and their way they were told to respond to them are strikingly different. In fact, they seem almost contradictory to one another. Let me explain what I mean. The first instance comes about in Deuteronomy chapter 24, amidst a series of laws about how the Israelites are to care for the poor among them. In verse 19, they're told that whenever they reap their fields for harvest and they forget some of the wheat in the field, that they cannot return to collect it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Likewise, when they're collecting olives from their olive trees or grapes from their vineyards, they may not go back a second time to collect grapes and olives that they missed or that fell on the ground. Once again, Moses says, they must leave these olives and grapes for poor immigrants and for widows and for orphans. And then after he gives them these instructions, Moses adds, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this." Now, you might notice that this is not the first time Moses has said something like this. In fact, he's already said the same thing twice before. And on both occasions, he said it in the context of God's commands about generosity toward the poor. In chapter 15, for instance, after he talks about those requirements to release fellow Israelites from debt and to free Hebrew slaves, he says, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today." He then says almost the exact same thing in the next chapter, in chapter 16, verse 12, when he's telling them about how they, They must include their servants, as well as immigrants and widows and orphans, in their communal feasts. He tells them to remember that they were slaves in the land of Egypt. And on each of these occasions, the implication's pretty clear. Never forget that you too were once destitute and oppressed. Never forget that you too once toiled and suffered. And never forget that you were shown mercy, that God Himself delivered you from your suffering, and let that memory inspire you to offer comfort and relief to those who suffer still. In short, never forget that you have been shown mercy. And then go out and show mercy to those around you. That's at least one response to a memory of past suffering. But that is very different from what Moses then goes on to tell the people in chapter 25. At the end of chapter 25, which has mostly once again been filled with various laws about charity and justice toward other people, and even to animals, at the end of that chapter, Moses' instruction seems to take a radical turn. Remember, he says, what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and struck down all who lagged behind you. Now, the event that Moses is talking about is recorded in Exodus chapter 17, and it happens right after Israel's exodus from Egypt, as they're on their way from the wilderness of Sin to Mount Sinai. In verse 8, we're told that the nation of Amalek, who are this nomadic tribe of people that have descended from Esau, that they come out of nowhere and they attack Israel and they fight against them. Interestingly, the Israelites, they actually win that battle. They defeated the Amalekites that day under the command of Joshua, as Moses held his arms aloft in blessing toward them. But now, 40 years later, as they're standing on the bank of the River Jordan, Moses reminds them of that day, not to inspire them to gratitude for their deliverance or to tell them they should treat other people mercifully, but to explain why they must show no mercy to the Amalekites. Therefore, Moses says, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, and the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. This isn't the last time that the hostility with the Amalekites will come up. In 1 Samuel 15, God ends up rejecting Saul as king of Israel because of Saul's failure to obey his command and destroy the Amalekites entirely. Then later in the book of Esther, one of the last books chronologically in the Old Testament, we discover that the hatred of the Amalekites toward the Israelites apparently continues. Because Haman, this advisor to the king of Persia, who is an Amalekite, conspires to have the Jewish people wiped from the face of the earth. So it's obvious that the hostility between these two nations is no small thing. But why would God tell the people of Israel to never forget how the Amalekites attacked them and to allow that memory to motivate them to destroy these nomadic enemies entirely? And how in the world are we supposed to reconcile that with what Moses says in chapter 24 about how memory of past suffering, slavery, should incline the people not to violence but to mercy? Well, in order to answer that question, I think it's important to recognize first just how unique the Amalekites are among Israel's neighbors. As you read the Old Testament, you'll realize very quickly that God's people have numerous enemies. The Egyptians, the Edomites, the various Canaanite tribes, the Assyrians, the Babylonians. But Amalek isn't like those other enemies. Because as bad as those enemies are, and as much as God may bring judgment upon them, there is still some expectation within the Old Testament that God will bring redemption to these nations in the end. But the Amalekites are different. As Patrick Miller puts it in his commentary on this passage, When other peoples are spoken about negatively in the biblical tradition, other more favorable perspectives toward them are usually also somewhere in the tradition. But that is not the case with the Amalekites. No, for some reason, God says nothing about showing mercy toward the Amalekites. For some reason, his only attitude toward them is one of opposition and judgment. And that's puzzled a lot of readers. And it's prompted different explanations. The Jewish rabbi and philosopher, Jonathan Sacks, for instance, he suggests that what distinguishes the Amalekites and their hostility toward Israel is that it seems to arise for no apparent reason. It is, in his words, an irrational hatred. And that's different from other nations. The Egyptians, they had a reason for their hostility toward the Hebrews. It's because they were afraid of them, because they were afraid of their numbers and what they might do if they ever revolted. Of course, that doesn't justify their violence, but it does at least give it a reason. Other nations attacked Israel for territorial reasons. But the Amalekites weren't being threatened by the Israelites, nor were they trying to protect some homeland when they attacked. What's more, as Moses says in Deuteronomy, the Amalekites attacked when the Israelites were weak and weary in the wilderness, and they targeted the weakest and the most vulnerable among them, those who were straggling and lagging behind. This, as Jonathan Sacks puts it, this was irrational, groundless hate. Now, that's one explanation for what is it that sets the Amalekites apart. Another one is suggested by the Anglican Old Testament scholar Gordon McConville. He points out that within the story of Israel, Amalek plays a distinctive role as their first and perhaps greatest enemy as a people. In the wider literary context, from Exodus to Samuel, Amalek as Israel's first enemy becomes also its last, and stands for hostility to Yahweh's project with Israel. So maybe it's not just the senseless, irrationally hateful way that the Amalekites attack the Israelites at their weakest moment. Perhaps Amalek is meant to symbolize absolute resistance against what God is doing with Israel to redeem the world. And if that's true, then it may explain why Moses commands them to completely destroy the Amalekites, and why God is so angry with King Saul when he fails to do so. Because what this nation represents is nothing more than utter hatred and utter resistance to God's own work of redemption. But even if that's true, and even if that can help us understand the severity of what Moses is saying in Deuteronomy 25, what are we supposed to do with this passage as Christians? And how should we apply this command for the people of Israel to remember and never forget these past wrongs? Well, maybe the first and most obvious thing to say is Christians cannot read this passage as any sort of divine legitimization of international war or tribal violence. As Ajith Fernando very bluntly puts it, instructions like this cannot be used to justify ethnic cleansing today. And that's not just because Jesus advocated nonviolence to his disciples. It's because, as the Bible later makes clear, the hostility, the opposition toward God's work of redemption, it ultimately doesn't come from individual nations or violent political leaders. Ultimately, the hostility and resistance to God's work of redemption comes from spiritual powers that are at work in and through and among peoples and institutions, not just people themselves. As St. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. That doesn't mean that God does not still oppose, or God does not still bring judgment against those who oppress his people. But it does mean that what he ultimately opposes and judges aren't nations who symbolize this opposition, but the root cause of sin and the devil itself. Paul says in Romans 6 that it is these forces, sin and the devil, that attack and enslave us with irrational hatred, just like the Amalekites did, or were trying to do, to the Israelites. And in Colossians, Paul says that it's these forces that God brings to destruction through the death and resurrection of Jesus. God disarmed rulers and authorities and put them to open shame, triumphing over them in Christ. So it's not as if God has stopped caring about those who seek to destroy his people, or that he doesn't bring judgment upon them anymore. He does. It's simply that instead of the Amalekites, it's the cosmic powers of darkness at work in the world. But what then should we do with these calls that Moses is giving to Israel to remember and to never forget? Do we as Christians, do we have any way in which we can still apply this instruction? One person who has taken up this question and has given a really thoughtful answer to it is a Croatian theologian by the name of Miroslav Volf. In a book he published a number of years ago, he set out to answer the question I raised at the beginning of this session. How should we remember the wrongs of the past? And what does it mean to remember them well? And one of the observations that he makes in that book is that whereas Moses focuses on the memory of the Exodus for the Israelites, the central memory of the Christian church is the memory of Christ's suffering and death. That, Jesus told his disciples, is what they were to celebrate and to remember every time they gathered together. Do this in remembrance of me. And as Volf points out, there's something distinctive about that memory. Because while the Exodus is a memory of past oppression, both by the Egyptians and by the Amalekites, and past deliverance, the memory of Jesus' suffering and death is a little different. As we remember Jesus' death, we still remember past oppression, the oppression of sin and the devil, the hatred and spite that Jesus himself endured. And we certainly remember deliverance. There's something more, though, to the memory of the cross. Because as the Bible tells us, when Jesus died on the cross, he wasn't just delivering people from some foreign oppressor. He was dying in the place of guilty sinners. Which means that each and every Christian who comes forward at a church to receive bread and wine in remembrance of the broken body and the shed blood of Jesus, each and every one of them is coming forward not just as someone who has been delivered, but as someone who has been forgiven. Each and every one of us are the ungodly for whom Jesus died, as Paul says. And that is something that we must always remember. That is something we must never forget. Never shall we forget that God is opposed to those who oppress his people. Never shall we forget that God has brought judgment upon the forces that threaten those whom he loves. But also, never forget that you are someone in whose place Jesus died. You weren't just the enslaved and oppressed Hebrew man or woman. You were the enemy, and you were the wrongdoer. And just as Jesus died for the wrongs you have done, so he died for the wrongs that have been done to you. Just like Elie Wiesel, we as Christians can commit ourselves to remember, to never forget the darkness of this world. But unlike Elie Wiesel, we can never remember it simply as innocent victims. We must remember it as those who have in some way been a part of the darkness, those who have received forgiveness and been delivered from it. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Remember also that you are a sinner saved by grace.